Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today are semantic threat researchers Bridget O'Gorman, Sean Kiernan, and Alan Neville. Now, as we flagged in last week's podcast, this week we were going to do a special edition of the podcast on financial Trojans. However, we've decided to hold that one back for another week because we got the opportunity to include some additional new material, so you'll get that one next week. Instead, in this week's podcast, we're going to be talking about the Snapchat source code leak, how machine learning can be used in cybersecurity, how bugs and software code may actually enhance its security, and yet another illicit cryptocurrency mining operation, this time involving hijacked routers. But first, let's talk about WannaCry. As most of you know, it was the biggest cybersecurity story of last year and one of the biggest malware outbreaks for several years. Within the space of a day, this self-propagating ransomware caused international panic, infecting hundreds of thousands of computers worldwide, before security researchers discovered a kill switch for the malware and effectively halted its spread. What most people don't know is that WannaCry hasn't really gone away, at least not completely. Earlier this week, chipmaker Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing said its operations were severely disrupted after an outbreak of WannaCry at one of its plants this weekend. The company, which is a supplier for Apple's iPhone, amongst other things, said that the outbreak could lower its third quarter revenues by as much as 3%, which corresponds to a loss of about $256 million based on forecasted revenues. In a statement, the company said the outbreak occurred due to an error in the installation process for a new software tool, which caused the virus to spread once the tool was connected to the company's network. The company said it had 80% of affected systems back online on Sunday and expected to restore the remainder by Monday. So why are people still getting infected with WannaCry, you might ask? Surely, if it was stopped in its tracks 15 months ago when the kill switch was activated. Yes, the original version of WannaCry was, but since then there's been a few copycat versions circulating, particularly in Asia, where attackers have re-engineered the malware without the kill switch. So, with these copycat versions bouncing around, it means that organizations, they still need to protect themselves and remain vigilant and ensure that they have protections in place both against WannaCry itself and the Eternal Blue exploit, which it uses to spread to other computers. So, turning to our next item this week, it concerns some new research, which has some rather counterintuitive conclusions, namely a claim that if you put bugs in your software code, you may actually be making it more secure. Bridget, you've been reading this. Am I reading it right?
Yeah, you are pretty much there. So this is research from some researchers in New York University. And now I can just imagine some people who have to deal with buggy code on a regular basis just shuddering at the thought that people might add more bugs to their code intentionally. But there is a rationale behind this. And what these researchers are suggesting is something they're calling security through obscurity. So what they're basically suggesting is that developers add the right kind of bugs to software, ones that aren't exploitable and won't cause crashes or cause the software to be exploited, but will show up in automatic scans when cyber criminals are scanning code to reveal bugs that they could potentially exploit.
Okay, so the aim here is really to kind of confuse cyber criminals, is it?
Yeah, basically. So the kind of aim is to add so many bugs to the code that when black hat bug hunters are out there, they have to work really hard to figure out which bugs are actually real and exploitable. In their report, the researchers kind of detail what they say is, I suppose, a typical attack scenario and approach that a black hat would take when trying to find bugs to exploit. So the hacker finds the bugs in the code, then they triage them to figure out if they are actually exploitable. And then if they are, they develop and then deploy the exploit. So the aim of these what they're calling chaff bugs, is to basically slow down the attacker so that they would have to push many, many bugs through this triage stage before they're able to figure out if they're able to exploit them or not. Interestingly, they actually call them chaff bugs in homage to a strategy that was deployed during World War II by pilots, who would actually deploy a cloud of small pieces of aluminium from their aircrafts in order to confuse enemy radar and make them harder to detect. So this is really the aim of the researchers here too, is to make it harder for attackers to identify the real bugs by overwhelming them with non-exploitable ones.
Oh yeah, I remember that, all right. Well, I don't remember it really. I remember reading about it, you know, not that old. And did the researchers, did they actually try this strategy out? Does it actually work for them?
Yeah, well, they said they did. They said they ran their buggy software that they developed through the American Fuzzy Lop Fuzzer, and that all the chaff bugs registered as either exploitable or probably exploitable, meaning that a black hat who was hunting through the code would have to then do a lot of manual work in order to eliminate the false leads that were thrown up. And I suppose the tricky part of this whole strategy and idea is that, you know, you need to introduce a lot of bugs into this to make sure they're effective. So it's not just a small amount of bugs. And also, of course, you know, you have to make sure you don't introduce bugs that are actually exploitable. So these chaff bugs, they need to be constrained. And the researcher said that the best classes of bug for the creation of these chaff bugs would be staff buffer overflows or heap buffer overflows, both of which are often exploitable and so would appeal to attackers and would, you know, I'm sure they would carry out the further investigation on them. But the researchers also said that they're also easier to control and so are good options for the creation of these bugs. But as I said, you need to add a lot of these bugs to the code. So that will be quite a lot of work. You know, there's no point just adding one or two, that won't slow them down much. You need to add like a lot of bugs. So this is a lot of work. So I suppose you'd have to argue that would take a lot of time. So would they be better off perfecting the code rather than adding bugs to it? And when I was looking at this research and reading articles about it, that is a comment I saw on some of it, you know, on Twitter and on comments on the articles is, you know, is this really the best way to spend their time? But then I guess we rarely see code that is perfect or impenetrable, regardless of how much time is spent on it. So I guess there is an argument that this security through obscurity could work well as well.
Yeah, I guess they have to balance the workload of writing all of those bugs or introducing them to, like, you know, the risk you're minimizing, or if you're minimizing the risk.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting though.
Yeah. Now, moving on from bugs to leaks. Earlier this week, we heard that some source code for the popular messaging app Snapchat was leaked online. And we've got Alan here who will be able to tell us more about just what happened here.
Yeah, so earlier this year, around May, the company Snap Inc., which is basically this organization that's behind the social media app Snapchat, inadvertently exposed some of their source code through an iOS update. So later on, people who are monitoring the updates, like, they do this constantly to see what changes have been employed, so they can kind of see not just what's included in the change list, but what actual changes they've made to the phones or the code that are being run on these phones, had noticed that this archive or this exposure of source code was available in the Snapchat app. They had basically tried to use that then to analyze it a little bit, but they were really more interested in trying to extort some money out of Snapchat. So they had posted Twitter updates and or tweets essentially saying that they were trying to get in contact with Snapchat to inform them that they had included some of this exposed source code, but Snapchat had failed to respond. So in kind of retaliation, they decided if they didn't respond within a certain amount of time, they were going to post this online. And that's eventually what happened. So they post this kind of snippet of this source code up on GitHub. And that happened basically about 2 months ago in May. And it had only really got noticed only recently after Snapchat had filed a DMCA. So, like, basically enacting this Digital Millennium Copyright Act to request that GitHub remove the source code. And in doing so, kind of inadvertently confirmed that this was actually legitimate in a way, and it actually was something that was from their source code base.
Okay, so was it on GitHub for long, do you know? Has it been up there since May?
So it had been up there since at least May. You can see when you look at the GitHub repo, the commits, so the dates anything files were committed after the repository was created, and you can see that it was up there since May, and we didn't see the DMCA notice being posted by GitHub until, I think, 4 or 5 days ago.
So that's like nearly maybe 3 months it could have been up there, all right. And GitHub, that's publicly accessible to anybody. Anybody can go on there and
exactly,
get code
yeah.
that's posted there. Yeah. So for the uninitiated, why is a source code leak bad? Why would Snapchat or indeed Snapchat users be worried about this?
So I suppose the impact here, like any organization who particularly hold IP, especially for businesses who kind of run business models based on applications or source code or products, it can have kind of detrimental effects to those organizations. It can basically leak kind of the main money-making bit of their organization. There's also other sides to it as well. There's also dangers here with researchers using that exposed source code to be able to identify vulnerabilities, which then can be leveraged to attack either users of these applications or even the organizations themselves. So like, for example, we've seen previously with Snapchat where there had been vulnerabilities found in their online servers where people were able to go in and expose some of the images that were being taken by Snapchat applications. And they were able to use that to expose a lot of celebrity images, which then were, I think it was around 2014, where they started leaking all these images that they were able to retrieve from the servers, which are supposedly were supposed to have been removed after 24 hours, which was the main thing of the application. But this can lead to similar type of vulnerabilities being found and can have big impacts on our users, big impacts on the organization itself, and potentially the kind of money that the organization can make and continuation of the Snapchat product or brand.
Yeah, yeah, because I mean, it's pretty damaging to your reputation if that stuff happens, all right. Is this, like, does this happen often? Are there any other cases of big source code leaks that do you know about?
So thinking back, probably around February, there was like a big story that came out where Apple source code, so basically a disgruntled employee or a low-level employee had gotten access to iBoot, which is the main source code that's used to boot the OS or the kernel of Apple. And this was essentially shared around to select individuals, and they had essentially said that they shared this bit of code around just for research purposes, but eventually it got leaked outside that circle. And then again, similar to what's happened with Snapchat, it got exposed on GitHub for the public to see. And this had kind of somewhat bigger ramifications whereby reverse engineers or researchers can use that again to find vulnerabilities, and they can apply this not to only Apple products but like the iPhones, for example. So they can be using jailbreaking, they can be using finding vulnerabilities to be able to get access to these phones or attack users and kind of break their security model. So it can have big effects in that regard.
Yeah, and it's not that like a hypothetical risk, because as Bridget mentioned there, like, people are actively out there scanning software trying to find vulnerabilities in it all the time,
you know? Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to our next item. We've already spoken before on the podcast about illicit cryptocurrency mining, which essentially involves cyber criminals hijacking other people's computers and using them to mine cryptocurrencies for themselves. Our own research found that it was a big growth area in cybercrime in 2017, with about like an 8,500% increase in detections of cryptocurrency mining malware over the course of the year. And there was a veritable explosion of browser-based attacks too, where websites run scripts that allow them to use visitors' computers to mine cryptocurrencies for them. In 2018, we haven't seen much of a let-up in this kind of activity, and yet another cryptocurrency mining operation was discovered this week, this time involving routers. Bridget, you know more about this one, do you?
Yes, I do. So as you said, we have discussed coin mining on this podcast already, as it's really the story of the last year or so. And we probably did mention the likelihood of IoT devices being targeted more. And as you said, this is what we have seen happening in this latest story. So this story broke just last week. And according to reports, more than 200,000 routers from a company called MikroTik have been infected in this cryptojacking campaign, or campaigns. It's potentially two campaigns, but the vast majority, one campaign seems to be behind the vast majority of these infections, with a second campaign then responsible for some of them more recently.
Okay, so when did this all begin? When did it kick off?
Yeah, so it seems to have just begun at the end of July, the start of this month in Brazil, which is where we have seen the most infections, although it did subsequently spread around the globe. So we do have infections all over the world now. But in the first kind of stage of this campaign, around 72,000 routers were infected in Brazil alone. And researchers have said that it looks like the attacker exploited a vulnerability in the Winbox component of these MikroTik routers that was discovered in April. Now, as we so often hear in these stories, its vulnerability had been patched, but as it makes clear, as this attack makes clear, not all the routers had had the patch applied. So when this vulnerability was made public back in April, you know, it was analysed by researchers and various proof of concept codes related to it were published on GitHub. And it seems that the attacker used one of these to alter the traffic passing through these routers. And then they injected a copy of the CoinHive library inside all of the pages that were being served through the router. So injecting CoinHive, which facilitates, as you said, browser-based coin mining into such a huge amount of web traffic proved to be quite, you know, noisy and noticeable. So it was noticed by some users and some posts, I think, were put on Reddit and things about it, which is what led to it being investigated by researchers. So these users, you know, they probably realised the kind of typical implications of coin mining that we've discussed previously, such as probably their device slowing down, you know, the more battery than normal being used by their device. And in fact, this CoinHive, it was because it had infected so many routers and was infecting all this traffic, it was being injected in so many pages that even non-MikroTik customers were being affected, because some Brazilian ISPs actually use MikroTik as their routers as their main network. So it was being injected into just a huge amount of web traffic, especially in Brazil. But the attacker did seem to realise quite quickly that perhaps, you know, it was getting a bit too much attention, this attack, and making a bit too much noise. Because, of course, one of the key appeals for coin mining that we've discussed before for cyber criminals is that, you know, they can fly under the radar. People don't realise they're infected. And so they can kind of carry on these campaigns for quite a while without people realising. But that doesn't seem to have happened here because he was making a little bit too much noise. So in the subsequent later attacks that we saw after the initial wave, the attacker appeared to change tactics a bit. And then he was subsequently only injecting the script, the CoinHive script, into the error pages being returned by the routers rather than into every single page. But given he's infected a huge number of routers, that would still be, you know, potentially a lot of web traffic.
Wow. So it's like, you know, an affected user, it might seem like nearly every web page they visit is running CoinHive. No wonder it attracted a lot of attention. So how many routers were affected by this in the end?
Yeah, so there was basically the first attack that was observed. So the CoinHive library injected into about 170,000 routers. But then a second CoinHive key was also observed. And this was being injected into about 25,000 routers in that campaign. It's not clear, though, if that was a different attacker or the same attacker using a different key. We're not clear on that, but it brings the total number to around 200,000 routers. But according to a Shodan search, there are more than 1.5 million MikroTik routers available online. So, I mean, the potential attack space for the attacker is massive with the amount of routers that are out there, which is always the issue with IoT.
Devices. Yeah, you know. So I think no let up in cryptocurrency mining operations.
People are
still finding new ways to do it. Finally, as a lot of you may know, Black Hat USA, which is one of the biggest cybersecurity conferences on the calendar, is on in Las Vegas this week. One of the semantic people presenting at it is our colleague Lima Murku, who was talking yesterday about how we've started using machine learning to uncover targeted attacks. The technology is known as Targeted Attacks Analytics, or TAA for short, and we have here with us Sean Kiernan, who actually leads the TAA team, and who assures me that the machines won't be taking all of our jobs just yet. Sean,
I never said that.
How did this TAA technology come about?
So first of all, big shout out to Liam for flying the flag at Black Hat yesterday. As to how we came up with TAA, one of the things that we do in Semantic is investigate targeted attacks. So those are typically smaller scale attacks, but ones that generally pose quite a high impact or a high risk to the victims. So we go in depth on these attacks to kind of figure out what the attackers are going after, but just as importantly, how they are actually carrying out those attacks, because we want to ensure that we're providing the best protection to Semantic customers. So one of the ways that we do this is we look at the event logs that are basically logged by our endpoint products. So that's essentially records of suspicious activity happening on machines. And through examination of those logs, in the course of our investigation, we became increasingly aware of the trend that's, you know, known as living off the land. So that is essentially, you know, it's been talked about in the ISDR and in various different podcasts, but essentially we're talking about attackers don't rely on malware exclusively to carry out an attack. One of the things that they do when they gain access to a system is to typically kind of find out where they are in the network, find machines of interest, and in order to carry out those kinds of activities, there are many different tools and system utilities out there that are freely available either publicly or pre-installed on machines that they can actually use to very good effect there. And the reason that they do this is kind of twofold. One is that it actually lowers the cost of your barrier to entry for being an attacker. You don't have to develop custom malware. You can basically use the tools that are already there. And two is that they provide a very effective form of camouflage. So you don't have a new file or script that's running on your network. You have pre-installed utilities that are already there, and they're just being misused by the attackers. And that makes it far harder to actually spot.
Okay, so this sort of led us to the beginning of targeted attack analytics then, did it?
Right, so that specific challenge was really, how do we detect the misuse of these multi-purpose tools? So in fact, how do we stymie attackers' attempt to live off the land? So that kind of led us to what we had, which was we had a lot of log data. And generally, we knew that our investigators, when they examined logs of affected endpoints, could actually spot attackers carrying out activities using these tools. And they were very effective at doing that. We've got a lot of security expertise within Symantec, and our analysts are good. The problem is that approach to detecting things for customers doesn't scale. So what targeted attack analytics became about was trying to apply machine learning to enable us to automate the skill of those analysts in detecting those attacks. So that we would kind of do this in a kind of a three-step process. One was we would take machines that our analysts had manually identified as being affected by targeted attacks, and we would basically train machine learning models to recognize what that activity looked like. That's kind of at its simplest, that's it. We were applying machine learning to basically mimic what the analyst was manually doing. And then once we'd actually trained those machine models up, we would run them against the event logs from our other customer machines, and we basically see what those models detected. So did they detect junk, or did they detect something that our analysts would be able to actually flag as targeted attack activity? And what we actually found was in the vast majority of cases, we could actually automate that analyst insight. We could detect suspicious activity on up to thousands of machines a month that we were previously not seeing with our existing stack.
Okay, so that's how we were using it. How did we the next stage was obviously trying to get this into our customers' hands, wasn't it?
Right. So we had a long kind of bake-in from the initial inception of the technology. So we use it internally, like you say, it was used by our analysts to discover attacks like Dragonfly and Thrip. But obviously, we wanted to actually put this directly into customers' hands. And the way that we did this was to release a feature in our ATP endpoint product at the end of April of this year. And that was essentially an alert subscription service. So ATP endpoint customers could opt to submit those event logs to the Symantec kind of cloud. And we are running analytic applications on those event logs in the cloud. And when we find, through application of those machine learning models, a suspicious incident, we will basically create an incident, and we will push that incident back down to the customer's ATP console. And that will allow them then to see suspicious activity that is occurring in their environment.
So they get an alert saying, hey, we've noticed this, you should probably do.
Exactly. So they get an alert. That alert is like an English description. So they, you know, what are you actually looking at? To kind of give them some context that they can use to prioritize the alert, because we know that customers get a lot of security alerts. And then we provide evidence in the form of, here are the events that we saw that have led us to the conclusion that this kind of suspicious activity is occurring on your network, along with some recommended actions that an investigator can take to kind of help them basically shorten their time to remediation of that incident.
Okay, so what kind of incidents are we talking about here? What exactly does it flag?
So we've got a couple. So I guess the nice thing about this is because it's a cloud service, we can run different analytic apps that are detecting different kinds of activities. But to the customer, it just looks like one alert service that they subscribe to. But there's a lot going on in the back end. So we released at the end of April with four analytic apps. So one was literally a breach activity app. So that was there to pick up evidence of a malicious operator just active on your machine. And the second one was around PowerShell and suspicious use of PowerShell in an environment. And the third one was lateral movement. So did we see evidence that somebody was moving suspiciously between machines in a customer's environment? And then the third one was trying to detect a particular type of command and control activity. So that was in the initial release. But again, the advantage of the service is that we can add new apps in the background without the ATP customer having to update their product. So as we get new apps, they can basically get the benefit of that without having to wait for 3 months to 6 months for a new product release. So one of the applications we released just at the end of July, just in time for Black Hat, was the credential theft application. So that is specifically there to spot attempts by attackers to steal or dump credentials from users' machines.
Okay, so we can kind of progressively build this out and get more and more suspicious activity patterns baked into it once we're confident and can do it. Okay, thanks, Sean. That's about all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe to us to avoid missing out on your weekly dose of cybersecurity news. You can also follow us on Twitter at ThreatIntel or on Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you want to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found out at semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week with the promised special edition of the podcast, which will be an in-depth look at the issue of financial Trojans. Until then, thank you and goodbye.